Welcome to the Food Pod for Humanity, brought to you by the Food for Humanity Initiative at the Climate School, part of Columbia University in New York City. This is episode 5 of our series on plant-based diets and alternative proteins, and I'm your guest host this week, Ilana Schwartz, the communications and outreach intern this summer at the Food for Humanity Initiative. Throughout the first 4 episodes of this season of the Food Pod for Humanity podcast, my colleagues Josh Abed-Louija and Danny Din have touched on the many reasons and ways to consider a transition to plant-based diets and alternative proteins. Whether it's to boost human or planetary health outcomes, is it time to start thinking critically in some regions, especially in the United States, about the amount of meat we consume? We've heard about an interesting range of solutions so far. From policy instruments, to plant-based deli sandwiches, to insect-based pet foods. All of these solutions involve replacing animal-based products from our diets to some extent with plant-based and less conventional options, all while maintaining the nutritional content of the foods we consume and feed our families. But what if there were actually a way to eat that hamburger, that grilled chicken sandwich, that lamb over rice, etc., etc., exactly as you now know it? Not the plant-based version that uses plant ingredients and extracts like beet juice and pea protein, or the precision fermentation version that uses microorganisms like yeast or heme to produce specific characteristics like melty cheese or meaty patties, but a real meat version that is made up of animal cells just like the versions you buy at the grocery store or at your local butcher shop. Is it really possible to have animal-based proteins without the widespread consequences that come from traditional livestock agriculture? This is the question that biomedical engineers around the world are seeking to answer through their research into cell-cultivated proteins, or as some are calling it, cellular agriculture. Yes, I know the term cellular agriculture may sound a bit strange, but no, this is not some science fiction novel. This is reality, and this is what episode 5 is going to dig into, the science behind it, the advantages, and the controversies. In the most basic terms, this is the study of whether scientists can use a small amount of animal cells from livestock, poultry, or seafood to grow more animal cells, eventually enough to make a whole piece of protein for consumption. Whether it's climate change, food equity, animal welfare, food safety, or food security, the arguments in favor of this research run the gamut. And the research shows that it is in fact possible. Josh Abed and Danny have even tried cell-cultivated chicken.
It smells good.
The texture is really good.
Yeah.
There are some 200 startup companies working in this field today. In 2020, Singapore became the first country to approve the sale of these proteins, and consumers there can now find cell-cultivated chicken in stores. 4 companies are now approved for sale in the United States, and 1 is approved in Australia. But before we dive into the regulatory state of play, let's first dig into what these products actually are. And for that, we're joined by one researcher who's working on developing this science, Carnegie Mellon Professor Dr. Rosalind Abbott.
My name is Rosalind Abbott. I'm an associate professor at Carnegie Mellon University in the biomedical engineering department and also have a courtesy appointment in materials science and engineering. And I got into this space because I engineered tissues for regenerative medicine. And then this new application was introduced to me actually when I was a postdoc in David Kaplan's lab. And so I started thinking about using some of these techniques that we were already doing for a new purpose, and the purpose being these cultivated meat products. Cellular agriculture is using cells to create tissues that can be eaten by people. So basically the idea is that you would construct a tissue just like the one that you would normally have in an animal, but you would only construct the tissue that you're going to consume. So the idea really is that we're taking techniques that were derived from regenerative medicine, and we're using that same technology to create tissues for a different purpose, for the purpose of actually having people eat them. And so it's using this like well-established regenerative medicine technique, but then for a new application. And so yeah, it's often called cellular agriculture or cultivated meat. It goes by lots of different names, but it's essentially the same tissue that you would have in the body, but that it's actually been created in a lab instead. The process of creating this cultivated meat product, it does vary depending on what tissue you're creating or what product you're creating, but it all starts with taking a sample minimally invasively from an animal. So minimally invasively means that it's a small amount that's taken and the animal should feel very little pain. So you take these samples of cells and then you grow them in what's called media. So basically all the nutrients, it's like a broth if you want to think about it that way, that the cells really love and causes them to increase in number. So they multiply. And so you have large amounts of cells now. And I like to kind of think about this as like a bioreactor, like you might see if you went to like a beer brewery, something like one of those big vats that's like growing all these cells. So now you have a large amount of cells, and then you take those cells and you're either going to have them create their own what's called extracellular matrix, which is all the stuff around them. So it's usually like the scaffolding that provides the structure to the tissue. There's some people that are working on it so that you can either have them make their own, or you would seed them into something that as you've created. So you've created that extracellular environment and then you put the cells in it. So you've created some sort of scaffolding material. In my lab, we often work with sponges. If you think about like your kitchen sink sponge, something soft that has pores in it, that's where the cells would go into almost like a playground, right? That they can grab onto. And so they would go into that construct. You might grow it a little bit more just to make sure that it creates a large structure, but you could also potentially just seed it in and then that would be what you would eat. So you're basically adding in the cells and then you're adding in some sort of support that would be very similar to the tissue in the body.
Wow. Okay. So scientists can in fact grow cells into pieces of meat that are apparently quite similar to what we're so used to buying at the grocery store. But how might those products really compare in taste, texture, and nutritional value to the stuff that's traditionally harvested? You know, to the cows, the chickens, the pigs, etc. that are grown until they are slaughtered and butchered for consumption. On this, let's hear from Tufts University researcher Dr. David Kaplan, whose lab Dr. Abbott mentioned.
My name is David Kaplan. I'm a professor here in the Department of Biomedical Engineering at Tufts University in Boston, Massachusetts. And I'm also the director of the Tufts University Center for Cellular Agriculture and the U.S. Department of Agriculture-sponsored Institute for Cellular Agriculture here at Tufts. I have had a longstanding research career in the world of biomaterials and tissue engineering, initially for medical devices and to improve human health. And then about 10 years ago, we transitioned a lot of those tools over to the same kinds of challenges, but towards the production of food. So the idea is, how can we bring tools that come from medicine to make a difference in the foods we eat in the long term? I, along with some of my students, have probably tasted more of the products from different companies than anybody else on the planet, okay? And I say that with conviction for a number of reasons. One, first of all, to be clear, we cannot yet eat our own materials we grow in our lab. We have to have proper approval. We're waiting for that approval. We have cooked it and smelled it and reported all that. So we've done sensory analysis from the olfactory side, but we haven't been able to eat it yet. Okay, just to be clear. We're fortunate because we're an academic enterprise. We're not a company. So we just wanted to learn about all the companies that are producing products. So we went out to the West Coast, sampled probably a dozen different foods at different companies when we were out there, from salmon at Wild Type to pork to meatballs and bacon at Mission Barns to chicken at Upside Foods. The list goes on. I was in Singapore, and so we were fortunate to try the newly approved Vow Foods quail foie gras. We also were able to buy chicken nuggets at the market there from Good Meat. So yeah, I've tried almost everything that's out there. How do these things taste and smell and so on? Each company makes a decision on how much cell component is in their food, balanced with the plant component, right? And part of that is texture, part of that is taste and flavor, and part of it is simple economics. The more plant component, the lower the cost. The more cell component, the higher the cost. So I don't want to compare apples and oranges because they're different for every company. I would just generally say the food that I tasted that I thought was the best tasting of everything was Mission Barns. Mission Barns makes meatballs and bacon using fat cells from the pig. And it's about 10% cell-based if they're still following that. And the rest, 90% is plant-based. And having those fat cells makes a huge difference in flavor and taste. So to me, if I gave you that compared to what you may consume today, depending on your diet, you would not know the difference between what you buy from a butcher shop today if you do that versus eating these. They were that good. And texture-wise, flavor-wise, no question. And I would say most of the team that tasted that felt the same way. Just a few other examples, like wild type, their salmon was really, really good. Its selling point is if you looked at it and compared it to regular salmon without tasting it, you wouldn't know the difference either. It looks that good on sushi, sashimi. I would say the taste is fine, not great, but fine. And the texture was a little soft. But they've made, that was a year or two ago, so they made major improvements. Fantastic product. I think they'll be very successful. The pate from Val Foods, which is quail cells in there, was really, really tasty as well. So upside chicken was, you couldn't tell the difference. Texture-wise, cutting-wise, flavor-wise, taste-wise, was as good as anything I've had. I've had it as a chicken breast with them, and we've had it on pizza, like, you know, chicken sausage kind of things. So just some quick examples. If you were forced today to go eat that, you wouldn't miss most of your foods. They're as nutritious as what you eat today at the bottom line. The only time that changes if there's a huge amount of plant-based material, and if those plant-based materials are supplemented with a lot of processing aids or a lot of salt and things, then you can see a change. But I would say generally, you know, I don't want to overgeneralize, but generally the nutritional content is about the same. If you look at the technology we're talking about in cellular agriculture, we have so many ways to make the food even more nutritious going forward. It's already happening, not yet the companies that are out there, but sort of the technology being developed. So I think in the long run, cell ag is going to drive higher levels of nutrition and food safety and food quality as the technology really starts to make inroads in the supermarket. And that's based on science, based on the technology, and based on the facts. And so I think the future is going to be amazing, right? Because you'll be able to have food that's better for you. People talk about personalized medicine. We're going to be talking about personalized food in the next few years. That comes through cellular agriculture, not through any other ways to do it. So buckle up for that, because I think it's going to be an exciting time moving ahead.
I thought it was so interesting when Dr. Kaplan said Mission Barnes's products are 10% cell-based and 90% plant-based. It turns out that many companies nowadays are working on hybrid products that incorporate both animal-based cells and plant-based ingredients. But the percentage breakdown depends on various factors, including product type, desired taste, and cost. Hybrid products are typically cheaper to produce than 100% cell-based products. According to reports from 2024, the chicken that's now sold in Singapore is made up of just 3% cultivated chicken cells. Upside Foods, on the other hand, makes a piece of chicken from 99% chicken cells. The Good Food Institute, a think tank working to advance research on alternative proteins, notes that more research is needed to find the ideal hybrid ratio. Okay, so this certainly sounds like it might have some promise, but ultimately, seeing these products in your average grocery store may still be years down the line. As I said earlier, only 4 companies have approval to sell these products in the United States, and the approval process is time-consuming. Companies that seek to sell cell-cultivated meats must first get approval from the Food and Drug Administration before they can even apply for approval from the United States Department of Agriculture's Food Safety and Inspection Service. The FDA oversees the early stages of the process, the quote, collection, growth, and differentiation of living cells into various cell types, such as proteins and fats. Then, for most products, though not for most seafood, regulatory authority is taken over by the USDA, which oversees harvesting, processing, labeling, and packaging. Melissa Musiker, who formerly served as the head of communications at Upside Foods, put it this way when Danny and Josh Abed spoke to her last year.
Regulatory approval. That is the number one barrier for us and every other company in the industry. It's a long process That's a good thing because we're assessing safety with the FDA and then with the USDA if it's, the product's amenable to inspection. And it takes time. And so for companies that are venture capital funded and operating on a very short runway, it can be a little bit scary because you're moving in a direction and waiting to get product into market, and you're dependent on this unknown moving target timeline.
Plus, some states are making it harder, if not impossible, for companies to sell these products. Earlier this summer, Texas became the seventh state to ban the sale of these products. Alabama and Florida were the first two to take such an action, followed by Indiana, Mississippi, Montana, and Nebraska. Let's hear what Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, surrounded by Florida cattle farmers, had to say on the day he signed that bill into law in May 2024.
They want to basically eliminate meat, they want to eliminate cattle, they want to eliminate chickens, all this stuff, and they want to create protein in laboratories. So it's essentially lab-created meat, and their goal is to get to a point where you will not be raising cattle, where you will not be developing meat like we've been doing for hundreds and hundreds of years in the state of Florida. And so it's not just a question of, oh, well, they want to put this out there on the market. If some people like it, they can do it. That's not really what they're going for, because they know if that was put out there to compete with normal beef, that they would lose. So what they want to do is put that out there and then say, well, wait a minute, you can do this in a lab. You don't need to do the cattle. You don't need to do all this. So why don't you just phase that out? That's ultimately the goal. And in the state of Florida, we've put down the marker very clearly. We stand with agriculture. We stand with the cattle ranchers. We stand with our farmers because we understand it's important for the backbone of the state. It's important for our culture. It's important for our heritage. So the bill that I'm going to sign today is going to say, basically, take your fake lab-grown meat elsewhere. We're not doing that in the state of Florida.
Just months after that bill signing, Upside Foods filed a lawsuit against Florida, alleging that the ban violates the Constitution's Commerce Clause. In other words, Upside Foods is claiming that Florida is trying to protect its own cattle ranchers from out-of-state competition, which Florida doesn't have the right to do. Here's what Musiker told us shortly after that lawsuit was filed.
We are pushing back on the law on constitutional grounds. It's a pretty basic constitutional concept of interstate commerce, and one state can't put in a law to protect its own agricultural community from out-of-state competition. It's pretty clearly against the law. And then also there's just the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, which says that the FDA and the USDA have regulatory authority over this. And that's really well established. So we're hopeful. Obviously, nothing's a given. Ultimately, we'd like the market to decide. We think that's the most fair. Let's get this product into market and let's see how people react to it versus creating even more of an unfair playing field. Because let's be real, agriculture's heavily subsidized, and that's particularly animal ag. Gets a lot of benefits in terms of the way that our agricultural system and the USDA are set up. And so we'd like a little bit more fair, a little bit more of a level playing ground if we can get it.
That lawsuit now remains pending, but the question stands, how do alternative proteins like these ones fit into our current agri-food system? Can cattle farmers benefit from this? Or could these developments be cutting into their livelihoods? Here's the thing about our current food system. While there is currently enough food to feed the world, despite the fact that efforts to mitigate global hunger have been unsuccessful due to factors related to uneven distribution, poverty, conflict, and climate change, that may not always be the case as the global population continues to grow. The United Nations estimates that there will be nearly 10 billion people on the planet by 2050, up from 8.2 billion in 2024. That means, according to the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, that agricultural production will need to increase by almost 50% from 2012 levels in order to feed the world come 2050. Increasing production to meet that kind of demand is only going to become harder and harder as the planet continues to warm. So might it be our prerogative to explore all options at this point? Perhaps it's about diet diversification rather than replacement? Let's hear what Dr. Abbott had to say about all of this.
We have collaborated with farmers in the past, and they've been invaluable resources because they know the meat product. They know so much more about what goes into creating good meat. So they've been really good consultants, and I even talked to them about like factors that consumers are interested in. And so they are very excited about the opportunity. And I think that they don't feel threatened by this aspect of providing another product on the shelves that's very different than what they have. And actually some of them, they get real excited about the things we could learn by actually creating cow tissues, for example. One farmer was like, oh, if you can figure out, you know, how to make intramuscular fat, then we could maybe even inject that into a cow, and then we wouldn't have to like fatten up the cow for years in order to get the fat in the spot that we wanted. And so there's like things that we can learn too in this process that can actually even inform things for farming as well. So I think that it's been very positive, my experiences so far with collaborating with farmers. And certainly I know that people are nervous about the idea that like, oh, if this actually succeeds, that we will no longer have the demand for those products. But I don't think that it's ever going to completely replace meat, the traditional form of meat, but maybe it can actually make it, you know, a better system. And maybe we wouldn't have as much factory farming of animals, for example. Then that would be good, I think, for animals and also the environment. There's this aspect too of there's a huge demand for meat, and it's only increasing as we have the population grows, as countries become more industrialized. They just want more meat, and farmers cannot keep up with the demand. So there's a lot of room in that market that even if we could take on some of it, we could have really good impacts on the environment while also helping to meet that demand of this increase for meat proteins.
Ultimately, these bans have only been implemented in red states. So why has all of this become so polarizing? Dr. Kaplan shared some thoughts on that.
I don't want to get into politics and things. I will just say that polarization in general terms happens because people feel threatened by something. It could be anything, right? And I'm no expert on the food infrastructure in the US. I don't want to pretend to be, but I certainly know that the majority of our meats are really controlled by a very, very powerful livestock lobby that is heavily supported by the government. I think you're just facing what anybody faces with new technology. How do you slowly get that new technology out there and not to be disruptive, to be an alternative? That's really what we're talking about. If for the next lifetime, you're only going to see an alternative. It's not going to be, and then gradually we'll see how to make this a better and better option. So I think it's value and a win for everybody, but I can understand why many do not feel that way if you're embedded in the current industry that controls the whole process. It's just human nature. It's preserving what you have and makes it challenging. And it becomes a very political hot potato. And I'm just here to do science and report the science. I feel like good science and good foods to come will sort of set the table, if you will, and people will want to try it. And there's enough people that will try this. I'm not worried. So we just continue to move forward. That's the goal.
Okay, but ban or no ban, are people really going to want to eat these products once they do eventually make it to market? The first thing to consider when thinking about the consumer acceptance piece of this is, how much will these products actually cost to make and buy? And will the cost match those for traditionally harvested proteins? The first ever cultivated burger made in 2013 cost $325,000 to produce. But according to a 2023 McKinsey report, production costs have declined by 99% since that first burger. And if they keep declining at that same rate, cost parity could be reached 5 years from now. It will, however, take quite a bit of work to get there. More bioreactors need to be built so these meat products can be produced at scale. The cost of the media, the material used at the early stages to help grow more cells from the initial culture, needs to go down. One way to do this is to stop using pharmaceutical-grade media and switch to a food-grade media, which would, I'm told, be significantly cheaper but hasn't been proven to work in production yet. Dr. Kaplan told me it could still cost consumers between $10 to $50 to buy a pound of cell-cultivated beef, a wide yet pricey range. In Singapore, it costs anywhere between $4 to $18 to buy Good Meat chicken dishes, certainly closer to price parity than those beef numbers. Here's what Dr. Abbott had to say about the potential that exists if the cost can come down.
I think that eventually, if we can get the price point of cultivated meat down to the point where it is comparable to traditional meat, then I think it will be available to more consumers. I also kind of dream that maybe if we can create something that's cheaper, like, for example, Wagyu right now is so expensive. Most people can't afford to eat that regularly, but that's a healthier steak than a normal steak. So my dream would be that, that we would get that down into a price range that people could afford the cultivated meat version of that to create another avenue for them to consume that kind of meat that is, you know, maybe cleaner because it doesn't have all these chemicals and also has that better lipid content. And so they could afford to eat a meat that's a lot better for them than the traditional version of it. So I'm hoping that someday we get to the point where we can have these products that are currently actually too expensive for normal consumers and make them more available to more consumers.
Plus, what about the negative connotations associated with making these products in a lab? Since its inception, cell-cultivated meat has been labeled Frankenmeat, a term that echoes the backlash against genetically modified organisms, GMOs, when they first entered the mainstream. I spoke with Columbia University master's student and Food for Humanity researcher Zoe Adamopoulos on this.
My name is Zoe Adamopoulos. My background is actually in specifically alternative proteins, but more broadly speaking, sustainable food systems. I am currently a graduate student in Columbia's MS in Sustainability Management program. I'm originally from Singapore, where I helped launch a plant-based chicken company called Tyndall in 2021, and subsequently helped bring and expand Tyndall in the US market as well. The premise of my work with Food for Humanity is basically to assess cultivated meat through the lens of GMOs, not necessarily to just equate them, but really to understand what lessons we can learn from them. GMOs faced massive consumer backlash, a lot of regulatory roadblocks and bans, as well as political pushback, despite the large scientific consensus on their safety for human consumption. So I'm exploring where cultivated meat faces similar obstacles like public trust, labeling debates, misinformation, and also where cultivated meat has its own unique challenges. All of this is essentially to identify best practices or recommendations that could help cultivated meat avoid the pitfalls that GMOs fell into. They're both controversial because they challenge people's sense of what is natural to eat, even if they've passed rigorous scientific or regulatory reviews. Also, they are both common targets for food misinformation on social media. I think the biggest differences are visibility and sort of emotional connection. So GMOs often work sort of behind the scenes. Like, you might be eating GMO corn or soy without even realizing it in a restaurant, or you could be eating meat from an animal that was fed on GMO crops, and you wouldn't know that. I feel like cultivated meat, on the other hand, is very often the product itself. So it's sold as meat, and taste, texture, price then become very personal factors for consumers because of that. And based off of those metrics, cultivated meat can feel more unnatural or unfamiliar. Another level to this is it faces unique cultural and ethical challenges around religious dietary laws and views on animals, things that these concerns weren't really things GMOs had to face. And in the same vein, I think on a more positive note, cultivated meat doesn't really carry the same baggage that GMOs do from early days when Monsanto, now owned and rebranded by Bayer, paired GMO seeds with glyphosate herbicide. They were sold together. And glyphosate herbicide is now classified by the World Health Organization as probably carcinogenic. So that pairing led a lot of people to conflate glyphosate's risks with GMOs. So it's kind of this like confounding variable issue that I don't really see cultivated meat encountering its own version yet, but I still think that the skepticism around biotech patents and corporate control remains something that the industry will need to address. Misinformation has such a huge influence on how people see anything, but in particular food technologies. With both GMOs and cultivated meat, I think early misunderstandings around safety and nutrition, or even just how it's made, it tends to stick with people. And once something gets labeled as unnatural or unsafe, it's really tough to change people's minds on it later on, even if that's not based in scientific consensus, right? So I think part of the problem is also that both of these industries are secretive. They have heavily IP protected products. And perhaps if their science is made available to the public, it doesn't read as accessible. So there's not a ton of transparency, or at least there's not a ton of perception of transparency. And I think that makes it even easier for rumors and misinformation to take root. For cultivated meat in particular, there's the added challenge that they're not the big established players the way that, you know, Monsanto was when releasing their GMO seeds. For cultivated meat, they're going up against the conventional meat industry with highly consolidated power in large firms that have, of course, a vested interest in controlling the narrative and protecting its market share.
So what recommendations does Zoe have for the cultivated meat industry? Are there takeaways or learnings from GMOs that industry leaders should consider as they work towards bringing these products to the market?
First and foremost, really decide as an industry, or even just as a collection of startups that are at the forefront of this space, pushing it forward, who and what are they challenging, and who are the allies that they need to form a coalition with, essentially to fix our food system, again, from a multitude of angles. And I think on the regulatory and public health side, being transparent about where cultivated meat comes from and what's in it is key to building trust. I think clear and honest labeling, along with working closely with regulators early on, which we are seeing in a lot of countries now already, I think this can help set consistent rules that reassure consumers and also keep things from getting messy and becoming fodder for misinformation. It's also important to respect the different cultural and dietary beliefs, be proactive about working with those communities and verifier, so like getting kosher and halal certification, because this is literally new novel territory that can't just be filed under convention the way the conventional meat is treated. So that helps people feel more comfortable with these types of products. And above all, proactivity and willingness to follow safety and labeling rules, even implementing voluntary labeling, can help hopefully prevent backlash, or in the worst case scenario, the rise of a non-GMO project style movement that could really hold the cultivated industry back. And I think my last note would be, I just really recommend that these companies make their products and processes available and accessible to credible health, nutrition, safety, environmental organizations, whether that's the World Health Organization or academic researchers, so that the science itself can clearly demonstrate the safety and benefits of these cultivated meat products. Building on that foundation, companies can then develop tailored and transparent communications grounded in reputable science backed by credible institutions. I found a really useful comparison to be in the supplement and sort of alt health industries, where products, despite being unnatural forms of ingestion, like powders or pills, have become very normalized and even associated with healthy living. So brands in particular that I've noticed, like Seed Symbiotics or Athletic Greens powders, they rely very heavily on clinical research to support their marketing messaging and build consumer trust. Cultivated meats companies should really study this approach, in my opinion, and see where they can replicate to foster that credibility and acceptance. I see the real potential for cultivated meat to position itself as a complementary supply to meet the growing demand for meat, ideally working alongside smallholder and family farmers that are often squeezed out by those large industrial meat corporations. Those are the ones also predominantly responsible for poor animal welfare, environmental harm, community degradation. And again, cultivated meat is just one piece of a multi-pronged, multi-solution puzzle. So as we reduce our industrial scale animal agriculture and transition to a more regenerative and ethical farming system, there will likely be a mismatch between supply and demand. And to fill that supply gap, we need to introduce more alternative proteins like cultivated meat, while simultaneously still supporting livestock farmers that will continue to meet the demand for conventional meat as well, just not at the expense of our environment.
That last point from Zoe really stood out to me. Cell-cultivated proteins may be one of many solutions needed to keep the world fed amid a changing climate, but a lot remains to be seen. Can these products be scaled? Once scaled, will they be more energy efficient than traditionally harvested meat? Will consumers even want to eat these? I'd love to hear from you. Is this something you'd be willing to try? Would you ever consider buying a piece of cultivated salmon, chicken, steak, or anything else for that matter, if you saw it at the grocery store next to the more traditional meat products? Send us an email at foodsystems@climate.columbia.edu with your thoughts. This has been Episode 5 of the Food Pod for Humanities series on plant-based and alternative proteins, produced and edited by Josh Abed-Luija, Danny Din, and Alana Schwartz of the Food for Humanity Initiative at the Columbia Climate School. Thank you to Dr. Rosalind Abbott, Dr. David Kaplan, Melissa Musiker, Zoe Adamopoulos, and Dr. Matthew McNulty for your contributions to this episode. Our theme music is brought to you by Pablo Martin, a producer and master engineer based in New York City. Join us next time for the 6th and final episode of the season on the latest trends in animal agriculture regulation, compliance, and litigation. Remember to subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already to get that next episode as soon as it drops. If you have any feedback for us, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email at foodsystems@climate.columbia.edu. Until next time!